Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of subjects and stories in the news. We'll begin with economist Jeffrey Sachs, who is a director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and author of The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. We will discuss how, in spite of the political wrangling, both the House and the White House would shrink our government back to the Eisenhower era with plans that would make deeper cuts than if we went over the so-called fiscal cliff. Then we will continue the discussion on how lopsided the debate is in favor of cutting government services instead of raising taxes, and how little the American people realize what they're about to lose, whichever deal is struck. Andy Kroll, a staff reporter with the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones, joins us to discuss his article at Mother Jones, "Will Big Oil Keep the Subsidies in a Fiscal Cliff Deal?" and how cuts in subsidies to Big Oil, who are now making record profits, are barely on the table and not in the cards. Then finally, we'll discuss the latest crackdown on dissent in Russia by Vladimir Putin, who held a marathon press conference today where he opined on whether the world will end tomorrow according to the Mayan calendar, and offered citizenship to a French actor looking for a tax haven. Nina Khrushcheva, a professor of international affairs at the New School, joins us to discuss the increasingly peeved and petty Russian leader who was forced to answer uncomfortable questions about corruption and a ban on U.S. adoptions of Russian children. And joining us now is Jeffrey Sachs, the director of the Earth Institute, professor of sustainable development, and professor of health policy and management at Columbia University. He's also a special advisor to United Nations General Secretary Ban Ki-moon, and previously he was the director of the UN Millennium Project and special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Development Goals. In 2004 and 2005, he was named among the 100 most influential leaders in the world by Time magazine and is the author of many books, including the New York Times bestsellers Commonwealth, Economics for a Crowded Planet, The End of Poverty, and most recently, The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Sachs.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
And you're quoted in the New York Times on Wednesday in the business section, an article by Eduardo Porter titled Goodbye Government Under Either Fiscal Plan. And frankly, it got my attention, and it's quite alarming to think that whichever plan we end up with, whether it's the House plan or the White House's plan, the government is going to be shrunk to its lowest, smallest size in half a century.
Well, this will confuse people, and some people will reject the analysis, so we should define the terms. What has been increasing is the size of the retirement program, Social Security especially, but also veterans and federal employees, and the health care spending, especially Medicare, Medicaid, and veterans benefits. But what we call the discretionary civilian programs, or sometimes called the non-security programs, things that are not the transfer programs that we hear a lot about, but are the government programs on education, on roads, on dams and levees, on our coastlines, on energy systems, science, technology, the justice system, labor markets, just about everything government does other than transfer money to individuals or pay for war. All of that is shrinking, and I think it's shrinking to an alarming extent.
And, of course, it's worth noting in this haggling that's going on, and, of course, we had today, we have antics in the House over Plan B. What is manifestly clear to me, Jeffrey Sachs, is that there is no vision here. We're not talking about a government planning our economic future. This is just kind of ad hoc mud wrestling with both sides, you know, going to the mat.
The basic problem in America is that the rhetoric and ideology of tax cuts has dominated the political scene now for 30 years. So we have a level of federal spending and taxation which is actually incapable of solving our basic problems of skills, technology, environment, and infrastructure. What we have is a federal government that now takes in about 16% of national income in taxation, the lowest level in many, many decades. The two parties are bickering over symbolism, basically. The Republicans, line in the sand, we don't want taxes for anybody, no matter how many gazillions they have. The Democrats, very carefully targeting. 98% won't pay any more taxes. Oh, no, now it's 99% won't pay any more taxes. And so it's haggling at the top. Now, I'm definitely in favor of the rich paying more in taxes, but the difference of the two parties is really tiny when it comes to the big picture. Neither party wants to raise enough revenues actually to fund normal government in the sense that Canada or Sweden or Germany or other countries that are solving problems would allow us to do the same. And that's why we don't actually do anything other than war and transfer payments for pensions through Social Security or through the health programs. Our government is just shrinking to the point where we don't have a climate change program in the U.S. We don't have an energy program in the U.S. We don't have a rebuilding and infrastructure program for those people who travel abroad as part of their work. They know that when they go to foreign airports or get on a foreign train, it's an experience that they will not have in the United States these days because our infrastructure is typically 30, 40, if you're on the East Coast like I am, 50 years old. And we feel it, and we're not investing in our future right now, and neither party is doing it. The president gives speeches about how important it is, but his programs for tax policy, maybe because he's made a correct political judgment, maybe because he's not leading, but either way, his policies are not going to fund the kind of turnaround that we need.
Again, I'm speaking with Jeffrey Sachs, who's the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and the author of The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. Of course, the U.S. is unique amongst the advanced countries in as much as it's not really a social democracy. In social democracies, there's a understood compact between the voters and the politicians that you vote for people who actually deliver government services, and if they do it poorly and are poor stewards of your tax money, you boot them out. Here we vote for all kinds of extraneous reasons, like abortion and other issues, and we have a House of Representatives that's highly ideological and is dominated by a combination of market fundamentalists and religious fundamentalists. They seem to be in charge of the dialogue on that side. But on the White House side, why capitulate? Why go along with the evisceration of government and, in effect, buy into that canard that's been floated for so long that Reagan, of course, beat the drum over the idea that government is the problem?
First, if you've ever had the chance to watch or listen to a Swedish campaign debate, Americans could not understand it. The literal charge is, my opponent will cut your taxes. I promise I will not. And the reason is that in Sweden, they really like their government. Their government delivers. It delivers good roads. It delivers clean energy. It delivers clean water, clean air, good infrastructure, good schools, good preschool, maternity leave, good health care system. They like that, you know, and so they're ready to pay for it. Here, it's just so odd. With maybe not so odd, it's a discussion dominated by rich people who have absolutely absented themselves from social responsibility and largely live in a privatized system to an extent. Their kids go to private school. They have their private health insurance. They live in gated communities. They think somehow the rules of the game don't apply to them. Often, like Mitt Romney, they have their money in the Cayman Islands or abroad, so they don't even really have it invested in America. And all of the evidence that you and I would glean from newspapers and that the social scientists who study this carefully prove, the voices that count are rich people's voices. The social issues are a distraction. These are the alliances that rich people have made to bring, say, an evangelical community or to bring disgruntled whites who don't want their money spent on Hispanic or others. There are all sorts of social tags and social identity issues here, but the core of it is very clear in the political science research, which is that we are in a country where it's the rich people's voices that count. It counts mainly through the political system and the lobbying system. Lobbying is maybe now around a $5 billion a year business, and the campaigns are roughly a $6 to $7 billion a year business. Both the President Obama and Mitt Romney each raised about $1 billion. While we heard a lot about President Obama's small donors, we should have heard more about the fact that the predominant part of his financing was from rich donors. For Mitt Romney, even more so, dependence on very wealthy people who put in lots of money in the campaign. So I think we have a system that's dominated by special interests. We have many other constitutional quirks. The truth is that our system only tends to reform itself with strong leadership. We've had episodes of very strong leadership. The two strongest leaders in modern times were the two Roosevelts, one a Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, and the other, the Democrat, Franklin Roosevelt. They were the two greatest reform leaders of the 20th century. I would put the domestic policy of Kennedy-Johnson years as the third episode of that. It requires a lot of presidential leadership to make happen. President Obama is a backroom negotiator, which is so surprising because he was elected on the basis that he would drive change. He does not use his vast rhetorical gifts for that primarily because his MO is backroom negotiations. And you can't win in Washington in the back room. You win by taking your case to the American people, not in the back rooms of Congress.
Well, that's what's so extraordinary, Jeffrey Sachs, is that the president doesn't do that. On the other side, you've got this peculiar fellow, Grover Norquist, who's funded by very, very bilious billionaires who are like the Koch brothers, who want to essentially destroy the government and remove it as a player. So you have a kind of, it's often been said that the Republicans want to take the country back to before FDR, but in many ways, the plutocrats want to take the country back before Teddy Roosevelt to the original or the last Gilded Age. So you've got Grover Norquist, who's only as important as the people who fund him, yet he gets a lot of ink. And you've got a president who's got the so-called bully pulpit, and you've got most of the people in this country wanting to hold on to their Social Security, which they've paid for, and wanting their Medicare. So I don't understand why he doesn't weigh in and why people like Grover Norquist get headlines.
Well, I think there's another part of it, which is that the president's time horizon has been extremely short because he's under also the thrall of a particular economic view, which says if you don't get this passed by December, well, market confidence is going to fall. You can't afford that. And that kind of brinksmanship has been part of the story in 2009, 2010, 2011, now again at the end of 2012. I think that it is largely phony. I think this fiscal cliff thing is largely an invention. And I think that the president tends to blink on these issues. He's already gone from a demand of $1.6 trillion over 10 years to $1.2 trillion. Let me put that in perspective. That's going from $160 billion a year to $120 billion a year. And for our economy, that's going from 1% of GDP to 0.7 of 1% of GDP in added revenues. In other words, we're already talking about tiny numbers on the revenue side. So I agree. I think that this has been the real underlying story of the administration since January 20th, 2009, when the president came to office. He did not have the revenues to be able to carry out the progressive agenda that got him elected. And I'd say for the last 4 years, his speeches I've very much liked, because the rhetoric is about the need to invest in the future, the need to invest in our children, the need for education, science, technology, climate change, clean energy, and all the rest. But if you don't have the revenues to do it, it doesn't mean anything. And he's not gone after that. He's not explained it. And I think his political advisors, who are cynics by and large, in my estimation, that's their job perhaps, they've told him, look, that's a losing bet. You just keep straight, keep calm, keep symbolic. At that level, you'll get reelected. He did. But what's the point? At some point, you have to govern. And that's what we're all hoping he'll do.
Well, but the point you've made, Jeffrey Sachs, effectively, is that the president had been reactive, and he's been reacting to kind of Tea Party tantrums, because it was, after all, the threatening the full faith and credit of the U.S. government that brought about the mechanism of the sequester and now the so-called fiscal cliff, which, of course, is phony hyperbole and an artificial deadline. But he's going along with this scenario that the Republicans have written for him. That's what's so extraordinary about it, is that he's reactive and not proactive and can't come up with a vision to trump these economic ignoramuses. By the way, they're going to do it again in mid-February. I mean, this stuff over the fiscal cliff is sideshow theater, but they can do some serious damage when they refuse to raise the debt ceiling.
I think that's right. The real issue here, ultimately, in terms of the mechanics of government and the use of the bully pulpit, is that the president is the only one in our system that can really put forward a plan. I believe that that is at the core of both good government and good advocacy, that you say, here's what we need to do and why, and you spell it out and you describe it. Now, in the American system, it doesn't make it happen in the same way that it does happen in a parliamentary system, because in a parliamentary system, you either got the votes or you're out of power, whereas in the American system, you have to win the votes. But it's still true that you can't win a program without actually having the program, and you can't make a program the way that President Obama repeatedly tries to do, which is in ad hoc negotiations, throwing numbers and policies in a mad scramble over a few days that are completely unintelligible to everybody. And I could say, even if you are a budget expert as I am, these numbers don't mean anything because you can't follow the baselines unless you're the inside of the inside, which I'm not. So it's very hard for anybody on the outside to really evaluate what this means, but this is no way to run a $3.7 trillion a year enterprise. The federal government is the world's largest enterprise, and it requires something more than a 30-day ahead budget. And that's not just because of the Republican holdup, though I couldn't say a single nice word about their behavior. I wouldn't. It doesn't deserve it. On the other hand, the president, to break through, can't keep going to the back room this way. He has to put forward not just a number, not just a symbol, which he abandons 3 days later. He has to put forward a program, and he doesn't have it.
Well, just in closing, Jeffrey Sachs, going back to the New York Times article in Wednesday's business section by Eduardo Porter, Goodbye Government Under Either Fiscal Plan, this is the most alarming part of it, and this is what you've commented on as well. But just to end up here with this little reality check, to put it in, I'm quoting the article, to put it in perspective, this would cut the government's civilian discretionary budget to the smallest it has been as a share of the economy, at least since the Eisenhower administration. When the quarter of the population lived under the poverty line, thousands of children still contracted polio each year, and fewer than one in 12 Americans older than 25 had a college degree. According to estimates by the Congressional Budget Office, even going over the so-called fiscal cliff would not cut as deeply as the deals that are on the table.
Well, that's exactly right, in the sense that what the fiscal cliff means, it would have meant, or does still mean, I guess, technically, is that the tax cuts of the Bush era would be ended. That's no calamity, by the way, because we lived under the rates that we would revert to during the Clinton years, which were pretty good. So ending the Bush era tax cuts is no calamity. It's just called a cliff by the image makers, the media, and the frenzy. But the reason that we would end up with probably more government, not less, is we'd actually have more revenues. Now, I think there are even better ways to collect the revenues, but the truth of the matter is companies aren't paying right now because their money's in the Cayman Islands or Bermuda. The rich people don't pay because they have so many special prerogatives. We have both political parties that have converged to a wholly inadequate approach to the budget. And the fact of the matter is we don't think ahead. So without a multi-year program, we're just getting ourselves deeper and deeper into a mess. And the only way to think ahead is to put forward a program. That's the job in our constitutional system of the president. I would still like to see him do it.
But the bottom line is that whether it's the Republican plan or the White House plan, whatever they're going to do is worse than if we go over the fiscal cliff. And that is a headline, as far as I can tell.
No matter what we do right now, we are not paying for civilization as we want it. And until we recognize that and decide that we're going to pay for civilization, our problems are going to multiply.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Jeffrey Sachs.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeffrey Sachs, who's the director of the Earth Institute, professor of sustainable development, and professor of health policy and management at Columbia University. He's also a special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and previously he was the director of the UN Millennium Project and special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Development Goals. In 2004 and 2005, he was named among the 100 most influential leaders in the world by Time magazine, and is the author of many books, including the New York Times bestsellers Commonwealth, Economics for a Crowded Planet, and The End of Poverty, and most recently, The Price of Civilization, Reawaking American Virtue and Prosperity. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about what's not on the table in the fiscal cliff negotiations, particularly subsidies for big oil.
And not your pride. We can go on and keep pretending. Oh, please, Mr. President.
Oh, Mr. President.
Where's all the money you spend?
All the money that you spend.
Food is running low. And they have nowhere to go. Quit slowing me down.
The grocer, though we have fun, tax collectors getting closer, still we have fun. There's nothing surer, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. In the meantime, in between time, ain't we got fun?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Andy Kroll, who's a staff reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones magazine. He's also an associate editor at Tom Dispatch, and he has an article at Mother Jones, Will Big Oil Keep Its Subsidies in a Fiscal Cliff Deal? Welcome to Background Briefing, Andy Kroll.
Great to be here.
And we just got through, Andy, talking with economist Jeffrey Sachs, who made the point, in effect, that the United States government is quickly becoming nothing more than a war machine and a pension plan, and that all discretionary spending is going to be eviscerated in this fiscal cliff negotiations, whether it's the White House deal or the Republican deal. They're both going to reduce the government down to a size smaller than it was under President Eisenhower. And that ought to alarm everybody. And the irony is here if, according to Jeffrey Sachs and to an analysis in Wednesday's New York Times by Eduardo Porter, that if we were to go off the fiscal cliff, we'd actually be better off than these negotiations that are going on, because at least in the fiscal cliff, some revenues are generated and defense is cut. So I'm actually kind of alarmed here to hear this. And now you're pointing out, of course, that, you know, the people who are doing better than anybody in America, the oil companies, they're not even on the block, right?
No, the federal government is a war machine and a pension plan. It's also an underwriter for the oil and gas industry. And the estimates, you know, I use a sort of middle-of-the-range estimate of about $4 billion or a little more a year in subsidies for oil and gas companies. You know, some folks estimate it closer to $10 billion. And if you just look at a few large items, tax perks essentially, for the big five, that's BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, you're looking at about $2.5 billion. But this is real money. This is nothing to scoff at. Yet it's really getting no hearing, no debate in this fiscal cliff madness that we've got going on here.
So is the way to look at this then, Andy Kroll, that this is a battle between traditional welfare, we call it left-wing welfare, which all the social democracies in the world operate on, where you pay your taxes and get your government services, or the peculiar form of government we have here in the United States, which seems to be more and more devoted to right-wing welfare, such as the subsidies for big oil, agribusiness, and the military-industrial complex. And what I find extraordinary is that in these negotiations, virtually none of the right-wing welfare is being discussed, defense, agribusiness, subsidies for oil. But most of what's on the table is what's left of discretionary spending. And the only vestiges we have of social democracy in the United States, which is Social Security and Medicare, Social Security, which, of course, is paid for. So the whole debate is completely off kilter.
It really is. And you know, you hang around Washington, D.C. long enough and follow the news close enough for long enough, and it really starts to warp your head, without a doubt. And you know, the characterization of the two sides is accurate. The conservative, I should say, the more dyed-in-the-wool Republican types, you know, they don't see a problem with subsidizing very large and middle-sized and small oil and gas companies. They trot out a whole number of misleading or downright inaccurate talking points to defend them, and yet they manage to persist. The Republicans, the pro-corporate Republicans support this and manage to either filibuster or just sort of spin their way into a place where these subsidies hang around, even at a time right now where we're talking about cutting funding for public education, we're talking about cutting funding for environmental protection, for food safety, for food stamps, for the already fraying social safety net, some of the things that you mentioned. If the government is cut down to the size it was in the Eisenhower era, but we're still spending $40 billion or losing $40 billion over 10 years in revenue to oil companies and gas companies, it's sort of a weird, bizarre place to be in.
Again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Andy Kroll, who's a staff reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine. He's also an associate editor at Tom Dispatch, and he has an article at Mother Jones, "Will Big Oil Keep Its Subsidies in a Fiscal Cliff Deal?" And we know that the Tea Party revolution was largely financed by the American Petroleum Institute, Karl Rove organized the 2010 sweep, and it was largely funded by the American, or at least they were the biggest funders of the Republican coup, if you will, in taking the House. And of course, they targeted state legislatures in swing states, and they brought about all the ALEC agenda, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They seem to have a strategy, undoubtedly. And I'm sure they'll come back in 2014 with tons of money and lots of plans. So meanwhile, you've got on the Democratic side, you seem to have a president who keeps reacting to Tea Party tantrums. The DNA of all of this fiscal cliff nonsense, that's a completely overblown hyperbole, that, and it's largely meaningless, but everybody's gone along with it. If you go back to how this happened, it's because of a Tea Party tantrum over the debt ceiling, which led to the sequester, which has led to the fiscal cliff. They're going to have another tantrum in mid-February because the debt ceiling is going to come back again. I'm just wondering at what point the Democrats and the president stop reacting to these irresponsible economic ignoramuses on the Republican side, who are willing to put the full faith and credit of the United States up for grabs, and start coming up with a vision, start coming up with a plan, and tell the American people, hey, wait a minute, we want a government. We want to be a part of the civilized world, not a part of the third world.
It's interesting to think about how the president and congressional Democrats have handled, you know, first the debt ceiling debacle of 2011, the failed super committee that came out of that the months after that, and now the fiscal cliff. It's interesting to think about this because, on the one hand, the results of the 2012 elections speak pretty loudly in terms of what Americans want, you know, how they see government fitting into their lives. And you had a president reelected who, in a lot of ways, has wanted to make, to increase government's role, or to at least make the role that government has, you know, more effective for everyday folks. And you saw the election of Democratic and progressive senators, and the defeat of a decent amount of Tea Party types. And so there's sort of like a broader takeaway, which is that, you know, there was sort of a big wave of support for folks who want government to have a more proactive role in the lives of Americans. Yet you don't necessarily see that reflected in the fiscal cliff, the ongoing discussions. I mean, again, you know, some of this can feel like a bad rerun of 2011, when it was just all about, you know, austerity and, you know, how deep can we cut. I remember in 2011 the president giving a press conference, you know, bragging about the fact that the cuts he was proposing would bring domestic spending. Again, this is the education, the environmental protection, border control, food safety, all that stuff, would bring that level of spending down to the Eisenhower era level. And that seemed shocking to me from Democratic President Barack Obama. But, you know, it's just the dynamics of Washington can be so bizarre and can warp what the rest of the country seems to be saying. And that message gets filtered out or it gets distorted, but it doesn't seem to be as pronounced in this fiscal cliff ongoing debate as you'd think it'd be, given how the 2012 election played out.
Well, Andy Kroll, again, staff reporter with the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones magazine, where he has an article, Will Big Oil Keep Its Subsidies in a Fiscal Cliff Deal? I just don't understand, though, how, you know, obviously the Republicans and the right in this country are much cleverer at framing things. They came up with this fiscal cliff thing. The press seems to love it. They repeat it faithfully, endlessly, even though it is largely bogus hyperbole. But the other part of it that I find extraordinary here is that this peculiar character, Grover Norquist, is treated almost like an equal player with the president. You know, it's Grover's telling the Republicans what to do, and the president's basically carrying the water for the Democrats. And this guy, you know, he's a joke. I mean, he's only important because a bunch of ultra-right-wing Republican billionaires like the Koch brothers are funding him. And I just don't understand how the press could be giving this guy as much attention as he has. And I assume the reason is that somehow Obama's not using the bully pulpit. I mean, why would this fellow that is jokingly referred to as Liberace with a wife have so much influence in that town that you're in, I'm sorry for you, Andy, than the guy in the White House?
Yeah, it's an absolute case study in the bizarre power dynamics of Washington, D.C. Grover Norquist has found a way to tap into sort of the pure white-hot ideology of the Republican Party and of, you know, conservatism, which is, you know, opposing taxes. And he has used his anti-tax pledge like a bludgeon and, you know, has really, you say he's a joke, but he does, he is effective, though. He has influence. He doesn't shape the debate. He certainly has a major voice, a very outsized voice for a guy who's more or less just an activist. He just happens to be a well-known activist, a well-recognized activist.
But he's well-heeled, though, Andy, because he's got all that billionaire money behind him, and this is what's amazing: the power of money versus the absence of people. I just wish that there was a way that more people understood that they have got to step up and defend Social Security and Medicare, because people like Grover Norquist have this disproportionate influence because of the huge amount of money behind them, and the press go along with it. I mean, what do you think is going to level the playing field?
I think that, you know, what levels the playing field is either a chorus of voices, a groundswell of folks countering Grover Norquist's influence. I mean, the way you've got to think about it, and sort of the brilliance of Grover Norquist's pledge, his anti-tax pledge, which he gets lawmakers to sign, is that he holds it against them if they don't abide by it. The number one thing that almost every lawmaker in Washington cares about is self-preservation. Will I get reelected in 2 years or 4 years or 6 years? And you've got everything is looked at through that prism. And so if they sign Grover Norquist's pledge and then violate it and, you know, vote to raise taxes, he will go in, you know, he will bring that into their primary the next time that lawmaker runs for office and use it against them and try to get that person knocked out of office. And so these folks are always thinking about, you know, oh, is this going to hurt me in my next campaign? You've got to have a force that counters Grover Norquist, and whether that is just popular support for saying, hey, look, you know, the tax anti-tax fever has gone on too long. We're starving the federal government. Food is being served to people that is unhealthy because it's not being expected. You know, the environment is being degraded because we don't have the money to protect it. Those kinds of things. It's either that or it's, you know, someone else in this super PAC era, post-Citizens United era we have, it's someone else coming with a ton of money and saying, oh, hey, yeah, I'm a moderate. You can vote to raise taxes. I will cover you with my super PAC or whatever if you do. You know, like, for instance, an example of that is Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York. He has a super PAC that gives political cover to Republicans, well, really moderates, who dare to disagree with the NRA. They support gun control, and his super PAC comes in and supports you for that. So there's got to be some other force, whether it is getting people in or getting some person's money in, to take away all that power from Grover Norquist. And until they do, he's going to be a force.
Well, Andy Kroll, it looks as if he's winning, doesn't it? I mean, he's famous for having said that he wants to shrink government down to a size where it can drown it in a bathtub.
Yep.
And the fact that we're in a situation, according to a lot of analysts, and I just spoke with the economist Jeffrey Sachs, that either way in this deal, whether the White House deal is done or whether the Republican House deal is done or a combination of both is done, either way, it's going to be worse for the size of the government and for the amount of discretionary spending that's going to be cut. It is going to be worse than what would happen if we just went over the fiscal cliff, because at least in the fiscal cliff, they have some revenues. So here we're on this trajectory where we're literally turning the United States into a third world country in terms of its government. And as I pointed out, we're going to end up with a government that's just a war machine and a pension plan and nothing else. So this is the trajectory we're on. So you have to admit, and the American people apparently are being fooled by this idea that they're taxed too much when they're amongst the least taxed in the developed world. And somebody has to have an adult conversation here and say, wait a minute, we're all going to have to pay more taxes. The government needs more revenues and it needs to survive and it needs to get better. I mean, all we ever talk about is we talk about how much we're taxed, which is lower than anybody else. But we don't talk about what we get back for our taxes and what we need to hold on to and what we need to value and what is a measure of civilization.
Yeah, but those conversations just don't happen, though. And there's so many reasons why that is, you know, just sort of the bizarre, this partisan nature of Washington is certainly one of them. You know, the fracturing of media as well, sort of the siloing of certain types of media as well, you know, it works against having that kind of adult conversation. You know, I mean, really asking people is, you know, you want to pair the federal government in terms of what it spends on the things that impact your everyday life. You want to pair it back to what it was in the Eisenhower era? Does that really make sense? Is that really something that you want? Do you even understand what that means in practice and what goes away because of that? I don't know if that, I mean, I've written a little bit about it. I mean, I wrote a story during the debt ceiling fight, which was called The United States of Austerity, and it was essentially taking President Obama's claim about the, you know, cutting spending down to the Eisenhower era and looking at what that meant and what is lost and what goes away. And, you know, does Head Start, the early childhood development program, just disappear? Or is it severely cut back when all the research says we need more of it? You know, is health medical research gutted because of these kinds of cuts? You know, that these are all important things to be talking about, but they tend to get lost, you know, in the sort of fear-mongering about other issues, or you know, or debates about, you know, the evil or the good of Grover Norquist and those kinds of things,
which is what we've been talking about. I guess we're adding to it.
No, but we're acknowledging it as well. Yeah. You've got to acknowledge Norquist, but also, you know, I wouldn't characterize this as some of the gobbledygook that you hear.
No, I agree. I just feel trapped talking about it. But just in closing, Andy Kroll, back to the notion that the people who are doing better than anybody else, the big oil companies that are having record profits, that they're still going to be receiving $78 billion in subsidies from the government from 2012 to 2017, and it's not even on the table in this discussion. Give us your last thoughts about what people can do, because obviously our politicians aren't going to do anything about it.
Yeah, you know, I think back to the debt ceiling, when all the conversation was about cuts, and really the only thing that changed the content and the tone of that conversation was you had a huge group of people come together and get really angry, get really pissed off, and just say, this is not the conversation we should be having. These are not the kinds of policy decisions that we should be making. We should be talking about things like income inequality, not austerity. And when it comes to these oil, you know, and gas industry giveaways, really, you know, it just takes, you know, at the end of the day, for all the money that can be spent on politics, lawmakers are still responsive to angry Americans and especially angry constituents. And, you know, they can be just buried in cash, but They are still human beings too, and they still have, you know, say they represent their constituents and will listen to them. And so really, if people don't want the government to continue subsidizing some of the most profitable companies in the world, the government has to hear from them, and the Congress has to hear from them. And you know, you can do online petitions, you can send emails to your lawmakers, you can do whatever. But you know, when they come back home, when Congress goes out of session, whenever that'll be soon, you know, they can hear from you. But that's really the main way it happens. You're not going to outspend ExxonMobil or Koch Industries or Chevron but you can certainly try to out-yell them and out-argue them.
Well, Andy, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Andy Kroll, who's a staff reporter in the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones magazine. He's also an associate editor at Tom Dispatch, and he has an article at Mother Jones, Will Big Oil Keep Its Subsidies in a Fiscal Cliff Deal? We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how Putin is getting more and more peeved with the United States while he's throwing the book at a leading dissident.
That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call jewels to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. Where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say ride slow. Dude, don't let them play us.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nina Kresheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kresheva.
Thank you.
And in terms of the gulag of the Russian mind, we had a marathon press conference today in Moscow where 1,200 journalists locked in a hall with Vladimir Putin for 4.5 hours with no breaks, while the Russian leader expounded and opined on all kinds of subjects, including whether or not the world will end tomorrow on Friday, as anticipated in the Mayan calendar. I'm pleased to report, Nina, that Putin has said no, that the world will end in perhaps 5 billion years or maybe 3 billion years from now. So you can.
He was showing off he's good at math.
He also offered Russian citizenship to Gerard Depardieu, the French actor who's leaving France because he doesn't want to pay taxes. He said if Gerard really wants permission to live in Russia, he can count on a positive response from the authorities. So is he turning Russia into a tax haven on top of everything else?
Well, you know, he's a jack of all trades. He knows when the world ends or doesn't end. He suggests that Belgium, where Gerard Depardieu is going, is not as good as Russia because Depardieu is very much beloved in Russia as an actor. He was talking about America. He was offering his opinions of Syria and Libya and signing cards to children whose birthday it happens to be today and whatnot. He's really acting in this remarkably, I mean, I love the music that you started this segment with back in the USSR. So he is that kind of leader. He's really, the Soviets used to say about Joseph Stalin, he is the friend of athletes. He is the father of all children on earth and whatnot. And that's exactly what Putin was showing in the 4.5 hour briefing with journalists.
And, of course, just like in the Soviet times, a lot of the journalists were complete sycophants and were groveling before the leader. One of the journalists said, Putin looks strong and handsome despite rumors that he'd been in ill health. And another said that Russia should rename the disputed Kuril Islands, claimed by both Russia and Japan, the Putin Islands. And, of course, Putin very magnanimously said, no, I think we should call them the Pushkin or the Tolstoy Islands.
Well, Russia is big on culture. We don't have politics, but we have art, as it used to be through all our dictatorial regimes before.
So, Nina Khrushcheva, just turning to the content in the press conference, even some of the state journalists who are of course pretty much circumscribed and you know controlled by Putin. Nevertheless, there were some tough questions, and Putin was asked about this. A law that they're instituting to prevent Americans from adopting Russian children, and one of the questions was that why is Putin making the most destitute and helpless children into instruments of political battles? And then another question was called the law cannibalistic, and all this is happening, of course, on live on Russian television. But Putin's answer was bizarre. He said that this is because the United States is humiliating Russia. And do you think that's normal, he demanded. What's normal about being humiliated? You like that? What are you, a sadomasochist? The country will not be humiliated. I mean, we know what he's talking about. He's talking about this other law, the Sergei Magnitsky law, right?
Well, that's what he explains in the response of the Russian Duma to have the adoption law for the United States to prevent Americans from adopting children. And Putin himself actually didn't say that he supports the law. He said he understands why the Russian Parliament, in fact, put it forward as a position. Which they hope to sign into law, because if the United States with the Sergei Magnitsky law, and just to remind your listeners, it is the law that was in honor of Sergei Magnitsky, a lawyer for a British-based firm who was accused of embezzlement, which is typical Russian response to anybody who tries to be whistleblower against corruption, and then. Was ultimately killed in prison because he was provided no help to his health, and he was in very bad health. So he died in 2009, and the United States, of course, pushed the law through, and now there is a Sergei Magnitsky law, which is attached to Russian trade agreements, as it was in the Soviet Union, by the way. So there was another human rights law attached to various economic or financial dealings. So, of course, the Russians, who were totally incensed that the United States is meddling in its human rights affairs, decided that they are going to hit America with eye for an eye, and so they set up this anti-abortion law, so the United States families cannot adopt Russian children. The problem, of course, is that the United States pushed the law against various state officials who were participating or preventing Sergei Magnitsky from getting help and assist him in his sickness, because these were really official dealings by the state. By the state institutions, prison, the hospital, the legal system, and whatnot. But with the adoption law that the Duma is trying to push through, and Putin is sort of lukewarm but saying, I understand why the Duma wants to do it, is, of course, a pure revenge, because, of course, I mean, bad people are everywhere, and sometimes bad people adopt children, and children do die. So this is just a very imbalanced political payback.
Sure, but in the last 20 years, more than 60,000 Russian children have been adopted by American families, and 19 have died. The law that we're talking about, that really is why Putin is angry, is in 2009. Magnitsky discovered that a group of Russian officials had stolen $230 million from the Russian treasury. And these people, these tormentors are still around. He's dead. And the law has been passed sanctioning these people. But doesn't it lead Nina Khrushcheva to the broader question of What is going on with Putin and this sensitivity, if you will, allegedly over foreign meddling? But it really gets to the heart of what kind of regime he has. I mean, there have been trials in Russia, in London, over the Litvinenko affair that indicate that what's going on in Russia is that Putin is essentially the capo di capo. He's the head of a kind of organized crime organization. He sort of regulates organized crime, if you will, and he's the boss. And it seems to me that what really gets under his skin when anything indicates the kind of corruption that involves stealing $230 million from the state treasury, that's okay, but to steal $230 million from the state treasury, but it's not okay to adopt Russian children. I mean, go figure.
Well, but that is exactly the problem with the Russian state, is that, I mean, I wouldn't go that far as to say it's a gangster state, because then, you know, we're just very frivolous in our definitions. But it is certainly state capitalism, and in a formula of state anything, when there is one formula, I mean, the state formula controls politics, economics, and whatnot. There is no free enterprise or regular freedoms the way they understood in a democracy. Of course, then anything that is done against the state, and almost every single action of anybody who criticizes the state for its own corruption, then becomes an insult. And Putin is taking it this way. And as I said, although he really was not openly supporting that law, he says he understands, and he himself is very peeved, which, by the way, is always, I mean, it's not just the Putin-Russia response. It has always been a response of first Russia, then Soviet Union, and now Russia again, to anything the West does to remind Russia that it's not perfect. It's that greatness that it keeps sort of referring to and talks about, you know, kind of that reference to the Tolstoy Islands and, you know, how great we are. And every time there is a reminder that, in fact, Russia is less than perfect and has a lot of issues, especially human rights issues, of course, the very peeved response by any Russian, Soviet, and now Putin leader is always, who are you to tell me how to run my government? And that's what he was basically referring to, is that it's not, that's why he called the journalist sadomasochistic, is that even if you are speaking for the United States, or at least agreeing with the United States, you by definition become an enemy, because the enemy of my enemy, or the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and vice versa. So if you are a friend of my enemy, then you're my enemy too.
But anybody who stands up and talks about corruption and takes on the government is pursued.
Immediately shut down.
Well, look what happened to Alexei Navalny, the guy that coined the phrase that Putin's party is a party of thieves and swindlers.
And crooks, yeah. Crooks and thieves.
Yes. So, well, Nina, I thank you very much for joining us. I stand corrected. It's not a government of gangsters, but it certainly is not.
It's a very corrupt government.
Yes,
it's a very corrupt state that we are not disagreeing on.
Yeah. Well, let's stay in touch, and I hope next time we talk, we have some better news to talk about.
Well, I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushchev, who's a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. And she's currently working on a book, The Losh Khrushchev, a Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at Ian Masters facebook.com /IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.